right, well, the subject is beyond rights, animal ethics and the Christian approach. We will be talking about rights, but hold on. The language of rights is a very blunt instrument. Can you all hear me, by the way? I've got a boomy kind of voice. Even human rights, product of the French Revolution and those turbulent times, even human rights are subject to countless definitions, exceptions and challenges, and that's with well-paid lawyers and lots of NGOs examining every nook and cranny in the edifice of rights. With animal rights, there's little chance. There are too many questions, such as, where do you draw the line down the chain of being? Who will pursue cases in the courts? Which is where rights are tested. No point in having rights if they're not tested in court. Not only do they require legal backing, but Raymond Geiter, a philosopher, suggests that rights need force to back them up. And I really can't see Obama or Cameron threatening to nuke factory farms. So the notion of rights...
Only once you've got the animals out.
The notion of rights depends on human communities deciding that the weak and powerless are entitled to just treatment because of something innately worthy about them, and that charity is not enough to secure that treatment. Many human communities do not think that even human beings in themselves have such entitlement. And indeed, in the West, we don't give the right to life to the unborn, to enemies in the field, or in many states of the USA, where capital punishment is still exercised, to criminals. So one hurdle that has to be overcome is that of getting society to recognise that there is something innately worthy about animals. Now, Henry Salt did a great thing in his 1912 book, called Animal Rights, by bringing the subject into general discourse. And that book influenced such people as Gandhi, who acknowledged the dead, Bernard Shaw, and the whole early 20th century vegetarian movement. But one problem that is that rights language does so often lead to the maddening argument, the deontological argument, that it has to be balanced by duties. You've all heard that. Ah, well. Although human rights advocates go to great lengths to get around the problem of having people who are too young, too old, or too mentally infirm to be able to exercise those duties. People do say that we humans have a moral duty not to inflict suffering on animals, which surely implies that animals, therefore, have the right to have suffering not inflicted upon them. But that right is not, that logic is not generally followed up. However, Tom Regan, a person who many of you know, did follow this up and develop the idea of animals being subjects of a life. In other words, that they were not merely objects in the universe, judged entirely from the human standpoint, but they themselves have an eye, an ego. They see the world through their own eyes. They are, in other words, their own subjects. They have their own desires, needs, pleasures, fears, and so on. Therefore, he maintains, that entitles them to rights. Well, absolutely. But that does not mitigate the problems that I mentioned just before. It still depends on us humans to grant or withhold these rights. And when our interests conflict with theirs, guess who's going to win? Richard Ryder suggests that the only real right that anyone has, human or animal, is not to have pain inflicted on them. His painism theory, it's okay, but it's too narrow, because pain actually can be good at times. I'm not saying the infliction of pain is good, but the suffering of pain can be good because it lets you know that you've got something wrong with you. So you attend to the arm in the flame if you feel the pain. Pain is also built into the cycle of nature, so a conflict of interest between a rabbit and a fox, for example, should instant agony for one take priority over the slow starvation of the other? Both painful. So where do you put your emphasis on avoidance of pain? There's another conflict of interest between the avoidance of pain and the restriction of freedom. I'm not talking about human rights here. Is it better for a songbird, for example, to be kept in a cage where it will live a longer, well-fed, pain-free existence, or to be free? is it better for a cow to be kept in a temperature-controlled, antibiotics, sterile environment, or to be out in all weathers and being bothered by flies? Animal liberation needn't take up much of our time, as the whole point of liberation is that it's the victim group that liberates itself. You can't liberate another group. That's not animal liberation. That is doing something charitable for them, but it's not the basis of liberation movements. Neither need the utilitarian theory of Peter Singer take up much time, the main exponent of animal liberation, as that can take us into really dodgy ground. Maintaining the theory of the greatest good for the greatest number can lead to places of sacrifice of the minority or of the individual where we not want to go. It's not even consistently pro-animal, because Singer agreed that where benefits to many numbers of people are concerned, it would be worth the lives of a fewer number of laboratory animals. So utilitarianism and the Peter Singerism is not where we could perhaps go. So having been critical of many aspects of animal rights, I should like to offer one variety of it, and it depends on property rights. Not everybody's idea of what should be, not everybody's cup of tea. But when I mention that the property holder is God, the creator of all, you'll see where I'm going. It's straight into Andrew Lindsay's theos rights theory. We do not have the right to treat animals as we do because God has the higher claim on them. They are God's property, not ours. He has the right not to have his creation abused. As Cardinal Heenan, and those of you who are au fait with Catholic history, Roman Catholic history, will be aware that Cardinal Heenan, Archbishop of Westminster in the 60s and 70s, very traditionalist cardinal, but nevertheless a very pro-animal man, wrote a foreword to a publication by Catholic Concern for Animals, in which he suggested that it is true that in a sense, not being human persons, he said, animals can have no rights in their own right, but he spells out the theos rights principle. He said, animals have very positive rights because they are God's creatures. If we have to speak with absolute accuracy, we must say that God has the right to have all his creatures treated with proper respect. Nobody should therefore carelessly repeat the old saying that animals have no rights. This could easily lead to wanton cruelty. The rights of God can be transgressed through ignorance as well as malice. Heenan then goes on to develop an ethic of kindness as a Christian duty proceeding from these rights. After discussing the nature of cruelty, much of it, he said, is practiced as a matter of business rather than deliberately, except by the perverted. He then remarks that in giving lessons on Christian doctrine, teachers now include the subject of cruelty to animals. Well, I wish they did. The best and most experienced teachers do not, of course, talk of cruelty to animals. They talk of kindness to animals. Christians have a duty not only to refrain from doing harm, but also to do positive good. This book, it was called God's Animals by Benedictine monk Dom Ambrose Aegis, will help Christians to do their duty. This is why I wish it a wide circulation. So for him, there are rights with corresponding duties, but you have to believe in God first to connect with them. However, there's another set of rights that can claim universal application, that non-believers can access. This can be most useful when talking with non-Christians. And it's one that the Catholic Church, at least, thoroughly endorses. It's connected with natural law. The physical laws of the universe, the movement of planets and molecules, are subject to God's eternal laws, or the natural law, as is the behaviour of living creatures. Each creature, human or non-human, is to realise its specific nature and end, to achieve fullness of its being through correctly ordered behaviour. St. Thomas Aquinas puts it that every creature moves towards its end, its purpose, its telos, by the development of its potentialities. The end, or telos, and that's why we talk of teleology, this is the ends, the purpose of things, the nature of things. The end or telos of an animal is to be fully itself. A dog, for example, is to be truly a doggy dog doing all doggy things. That's absolutely what it's there for. And it does that naturally for God's sake. Also, that the telos of all things ultimately is the glory of God. It is in this way that in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, a document partly reviled and partly admired, it depends on which bits you read, number 2416, which is the one specifically brilliant paragraph throughout the whole document, 2416, says that by animals' mere existence, that is in their very being, they bless God and give him glory. Aquinas also held that in every species, that which is for its own sake takes precedent over that which is for the sake of another. So, applied to animals, according to Thomist scholar Judith Ballard, if an animal has a capacity that is for its own sake, yet can be used by human beings, then the end that takes precedence should be the end that is for the animal's own sake. On the basis, therefore, that it is wrong to frustrate the natural end of an animal's activity, such as growing to maturity, producing offspring, and the like, it is logical to conclude that animals are not given their due by treating them as mere instruments and things for human benefit. That would be to offend against natural law, God's law. All rights, all duties, proceed from the first principle of doing good and avoiding evil. That's the whole point. That's Christianity stripped down in it ethically. Pursuit of good and the avoidance of evil. What these rights and duties are, Aquinas suggests, can be learnt by observing natural behaviour and discovering what the telos of each individual should be. Then our treatment of each being should be in accordance with that, with what helps it to achieve its telos and not prevent it from fulfilling it. The ethical consequences of this are expanded by another theologian, New Zealander Richard Wade, who suggests that violation of the natural inclination of animals, for example by the infliction of pain and abuse, deprivation of water, food, space to run free, and so on, is against the interests they require to have their natures fulfilled. Failure to respect the prima facie interests of animals based on their nature is to deny them natural justice. Now, it doesn't mean that we have to glorify nature. We have the fear of Cardinal Poupart that I was talking about to David this morning when he said, oh, animal interests, oh, new paganism. It doesn't mean that there's everything in nature that is commendable as a model of human behaviour. For example, we don't go for killing the offspring of rival males in a family, or as they do in a lion's pack, or lion's pride, should I say. We've been given the virtue of prudence, as well as of justice, to make the necessary distinctions. For example, also, human beings can feel empathy across species, which very few animals can, particularly those in the wild. Otherwise, the lion wouldn't be able to kill the gazelle, or the cat to play with the mouse. There's another solution defined by Aquinas that we can apply in situations of competing interests, and that is of proportionality. Basically, an action is unlawful if the good effect could have been secured without the evil effect. This ties in with the statement in the Catechism, another one, that one may not do evil so that good may result from it. Pretty straightforward premise to live by. For example, animals can be used for food and clothing only if food and clothing cannot be obtained by plants and minerals, or by animals only when real need demands, rather than preference, taste, and so on. Otherwise, it would be unlawful according to the natural law. to harm that which is higher in the chain of being, the animal, than the lower. So in other words, you must, in the chain of being, starting with minerals, in other respects I detest this chain of being idea, but in this respect it's good. Minerals, plants, animals, humans. And the idea is, in Aquinas, that the lower serves the higher. The actual gospel value is that the higher serves the lower, but leave that for a moment. But if the lower serves the higher, minerals serve plants, plants serve animals, animals serve man, man serves God. That actually breaks down when you think of angels, which are meant to come between man and God, because we don't serve angels, actually they serve us and God. So if we model ourselves more on angels, then we would be serving the class below us, animals, and God. But in this basis, if you have minerals serving plants, serving animals, serving people, serving God, then it'd be unlawful according to natural law to use a higher up the ladder when you should be using a lower down the ladder. So that works for us. Anyway, that's just to sum up. Animal rights, liberation, utilitarianism, paganism, all fair enough, but they don't go far enough. Theos rights, God's rights, God owns, he has, everything is his property, everything is his creation. Therefore, we do not have the right to abuse God's property of creation. Natural rights, God's laws of the universe, observable, leading to the telos of each creature, proportionality. And there's something else that I'd like to mention a bit more now, that's just been touched on, and this is called beyond rights, and I'm moving now to the virtues. I've talked about the virtues of prudence and justice. They're components of a theory that makes use of them called virtue ethics. And the church gives the list as faith, hope, charity, prudence, temperance, justice, and fortitude. Now, you might have your own list. You probably know more compellingly the corresponding vices. And there were programmes made about the vices on television. They never see a programme made about the virtues, do you? The vices: pride, avarice, envy, wrath, lust, gluttony, and sloth, or accedia, which means the same kind of thing, a moral unwillingness to get engaged with the big issues. But like Cardinal Heenan said about cruelty to animals, it's better to talk about kindness, it's better to talk about the positive. So talking about virtues means that by the grace of God, we are to cultivate, to practice on a daily basis these virtues until they become part of us, part of our thinking, part of our behaviour, till we properly internalise them. Following virtue ethics as a rule of life obviously involves following the good, asking, what would a good person do in this situation? Like the American car sticker, you know, what would Jesus do in any situation? But we don't just have to look at Jesus, we can look at anybody, our neighbour, anybody who is a better person than we are. What would that person do? And then I'm trying to follow the example of those people who exercise goodness to a higher degree than we do. So if we just take a moment to look at the virtues in connection with living with animal creation, they're not just words, they're rules of life. Faith, hope and charity, well, we can perhaps get our heads around those quite easily. But the others perhaps need a bit of teasing out. Justice, fortitude, temperance, and prudence. Justice, a virtue of giving to God and neighbour what is owed them. The Catechism, this wonderful paragraph, 2416, states that animals are owed kindness, so that the principle is established that justice is to be extended to them, either as a form of neighbour, so we expand our who is our neighbour to include animals, or, as the paragraph seems to intend, as part of the justice owed to God. Fortitude helps us to be firm and constant in our struggle to achieve the good, which must include justice owed to animals. Temperance ensures that a proper balance is struck and extremes not indulged in. This can ensure that in matters such as diet, clothing and leisure, non-human animals are not sacrificed for the indulgence of appetite, fashion, taste preference, or entertainment. Prudence helps us to apply ethical principles to particular cases in order to bring about the good and avoid evil. According to Aquinas, even animals can possess this virtue. Achieving the good for all living creatures and avoiding the evil of cruelty is a simple goal, but prudence is especially necessary in helping to decide between the competing claims of moral patience. The people we're doing moral things to. And what I'd just like us to do, to try and internalise a little more perhaps these virtues. I've got the virtues here. I was going to ask people to move into groups of seven, but in this confined space, that's just not going to be possible. What I will do is I've got an envelope with the seven virtues in. If the first person out of seven would just take the envelope, and if we could just count ourselves off into seven. So could you just start? Don, one, could you just say your number, and then you'll know what it is.
Two.
Three.
Four.
Five. Six.
Seven. Okay, so we start again. One.
One.
Two.
Three.
Four.
Five. Six. Seven.
One.
Two.
Three.
Four.
Five.
Six. Seven. One.
Remember your number. Everybody. You're two. You're two. One.
Two.
Okay, that's fine. Now, how many number ones have we got? Will you put your hands up if you're number one? One, two, three, four, five. Excellent, I've got five envelopes. Now, if you would just pass one virtue to each person in your group, and if that person then would consider how they would use that virtue in any given situation to do with animals, and then tell the person next to you what you would do with that virtue, and then ask that person next to you what that person would do with their virtue. So the idea is, it was going to be, if you were in seven, you know the old air balloon thing? The weakest person would get thrown out? You know, very virtuous. But we don't have to do that in this case. Can't really do that. So if everybody just picks a virtue and then spend a minute or two quietly just thinking about how does that virtue apply in your life or could apply in your life. So should it... Your number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So take one. And we've got two more. Just take one. Yeah, just take one. Right. So everybody's got one now, haven't they? That's the point. Right, now just think about it. It might be a nice simple one like charity. It might be a more complicated one like prudence or justice or something. Just think about how could you use that, when would you use that virtue? When would you need to exercise that virtue? You could think, I need that virtue when, because, it was an imaginary situation. Defend your virtue, in other words. You don't have to vote. Okay, have you all thought of how you could use your virtue in an animal situation? Animal justice situation, animal charity situation, whatever? Right, would you turn to the person next to you then and tell them what you have decided about your virtue? I need this virtue when... So, could you turn to Matthew and tell him? Matthew, and you... Oh, no, you're not. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, of course.
It's actually a bit difficult.
My math is never a strong point. You're not going to have an equal number, are you? Okay, what is yours then? Why? When would you use charity in an animal situation? I need this.
Pigeons. Sometimes see the limp road. Yeah. And what it is, they've got cotton on their feet.
Cotton?
Yeah, and they try and break it off as it gets tighter.
And they cut their legs. They tourniquet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the end of the
just like a tourniquet.
Also.
So what would you do charitably?
Well, I try and catch them and cut the cord off.
And I see before they get the to that tourniquet situation.
I have done that in the past, but I haven't done it recently. But I'm thinking, how can I make a pitching shot so I can catch them?
Yes.
Sometimes it's difficult to catch them, but it's always difficult. Also, it would be a good idea if the media would publicise this phenomenon.
It would, yes, I've never heard of it.
What happens is people grow peas in their garden and they have the peas at the cotton. They pitch inside the peas, try and eat the peas, and they get cotton up around their feet, and then they lose the peas.
I'll put that in the next article. I'll make a point of that and say, watch out for pigeons that are limping. They may have cotton around it. Just a quick sniff, and you might save the life or the suffering anyway. Excellent.
Thank you. With a scalping blade, it's probably better than an eye glass because it digs right deep into your flesh.
These new people are coming. Right, could you swap over now? Could you, would Mary, could you tell Matthew what you've got and he tell you? Right, thank you. You've all been doing great. Will you swap your piece of paper now and pass it on to the person next to you and take theirs? Just swap it so that you've got a different charity. And you can pass it down the line. Just have a different charity, a different virtue now. Have a different virtue and do the same thing.
I've got a virtue anyway.
You're without virtue, are you?
Generally speaking.
Oh, this one.
I didn't get to any
five.
Oh, same group. Generally speaking, yes, as far as I know, yes.
Well, thank you very much. You've all engaged fantastically. I mean, it's only a little one-liner. You don't need to develop the pieces or anything. Can I just have a couple? What do you think about, what's the first one? Faith. Has anyone had faith? A good idea of when they need faith in terms of animal activity. Anybody? Perhaps you don't need faith then. Can we ditch faith as a virtue?
No.
Have you got faith?
Yeah, sometimes you're in a situation where you've got to do something that you don't really want to do because it might be dangerous, but in order to save somebody or something, so you've got to have a bit of faith to just get on with it.
That God will uphold you while you're doing it, and you won't...
Actually, one of my biggest problems is actually despair.
As in
feeling completely...
Oh, but then I dare say fortitude would come in there, would it not?
I dare say, but faith is quite useful.
Yes, faith is very useful. Just remember
and
what
I
the
wish I had more,
virtues are.
And I wish it was easier.
Right, yeah, more faith and to make life a bit easier in our struggle, which is against brick walls so often.
Necessary at all.
It's not necessary. No. You don't need faith.
Absolutely not. I don't think it's necessary at all in regard to animal compassion, welfare, etc.
Right. People without any faith in anything can...
Well, it depends on my faith. It can be religious faith, but if you just mean faith in a process, then yes, maybe.
So if we cultivate the virtue of faith in the process, that perhaps what we're doing is worthwhile.
Yeah,
that's maybe. Okay. Any other faith?
Maybe it from a different angle, in terms of believing, faith in believing what God teaches, believing what the teaches about animals and about their...
Right. So that's it's a useful virtue to hold on to in that respect.
Yes, in terms of sort of basic belief.
Okay, it sounds like we'll keep that one on board then. Hope. When is hope needed in our discourse about animals or our work about animals with animals for animals in the wider world? Do we need hope?
Yes.
Has anybody defended hope here?
Yes,
and
well, more often was against it, I think. You know, people who speak out for animals and for correct treatment of animals are often up against it because there seems to be lots of voices shouting. And I think we talked about how closely related it was to faith in the sense that you have to believe there is a better way, but this isn't the way things are meant to be. In Christian terms, we talked about the eschatological hope that just as pacifists hope and work towards peace. Hope is kind of the theory behind what you do practically, working towards peace in a world where there is war. Then so people who care about animals will work towards a better situation for animals in a world where perhaps the majority don't go along with us. But nevertheless, we hope that things will be better.
So we hope for something and then work towards it.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be so completely idealistic, it's completely unrealistic.
Right.
I think it has to be kind of realistic.
Okay, it sounds like we should keep hope. Yes?
It's very important because if you have no hope, the opposite of hope is despair and desperation.
Mm-hmm. Which,
and
who doesn't get from time to time?
You need the faith, but to have the faith, you need the hope. It's very difficult to separate.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, the church is offering them. It's not saying they're in tight, watertight compartments at all.
But at the end of the day, think what should be the sort of and faith is we're not alone.
Yeah.
And God has touched people's spirits down the ages. And so we're not alone. It's not new. We're following a tradition pattern. And what encourages me, being a bit more practical now, is I think touching people's educating them into healthy aspects of education in all the headlines, major people.
Yes. The last couple of weeks, I think, yes.
People died in the end of the day, too much.
Yes.
And dairy. But we're not alone, we have hope, because there is a vision. Mm. It's a well-trodden path, it's a growing one. Mm. That gives me hope that when I despair, there's so much hope. But I pray to the Lord, I thank him for touching people's hearts. He's anointed people,
we
have charities,
right, so we must keep hope as something again to cultivate on a daily basis. To charity kind of goes out saying, really, doesn't it? Anybody defend charity, or did you just say, well, general, yes?
Charity and involuntary work that I've done over the years, and it's very hard work, but it's not hard work. It's satisfying.
But you can only do it when it's internal in you that you want to do it, isn't it? That
absolutely.
It's because you've internalised charity that you're able to then do charitable things.
Yes.
I had an example from Stuart about the charitable activity of seeing a pigeon with thread around its legs, that if you see a lame pigeon, as he often does, they've often got string or twine or something around their legs.
Cotton.
And that can tourniquet on them and cause their feet to drop off and give them tremendous suffering, which all you need to do is to catch it and cut the string. You know, just a small act of charity can be a huge effect for the life of a creature. I say all. First catch your pigeon. Not so easily done, but it is done, and Stuart does it. Any other charity?
I'd like to come at it from a different angle, actually, because it's supposed to be the greatest, allegedly,
it
but
is.
It's also the most difficult, as far as I'm concerned, when trying to be mindful, hopeful, whatever, of people who are perpetrating the evils against. So think it's the hardest.
Right.
I'm
Did
not
hear
talking
that
about the charity to the animals, I'm talking about charity to the people who
to
aren't
the abusers.
Yes. And that I find extremely difficult.
Yes.
I find it very, very difficult. Not to hate, not to despise, not to want to
throttle them.
Destroy.
It is considered to be the number one. That's important. Considered the number one, and it's the one that I have to work on.
Yes,
very hard, isn't it?
Yes.
Prudence. Did anybody manage to defend Prudence, or has poor Prudence got to go? Prudence, anybody?
I think thinking carefully about the situation so that you can act practically when situations come up. How we're interpreting it.
Discernment, sort of that kind of...
And wisdom as well. Yes. It's a very practical word.
It is,
I found this really, really helpful, just kind of think through situations, scenarios, how I would, and what's important. So when an unexpected situation comes to us, and think, you seem to be able to think, yeah, this is possibly the best way forward.
Or maybe maybe there's another agency that can deal with this better than I can, and that sort of thing. Yeah.
And I think that just in the practical engagement with issues, as far as animals are concerned, it's a constant requirement.
Right, I agree. I think it's a really important one. It's like Jesus saying, you know, don't build a tower until you've worked out the costings for it and you've got the foundations right and,
foundations
and everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anybody else defend prudence, or is that good enough for everybody? We'll all... Something we need to cultivate, perhaps, because some of us can be led a bit by the heart rather than the head and rush in, and perhaps standing back and working out which is the best way of coping with the situation would be the best. Okay, what about, who's the next chap? Temperance. Sounds very boring, doesn't it? Very sort of puritanical, but
just
it isn't actually.
I was thinking more in terms of a temperate attitude, and just as being said with prudence, it is a constant requirement.
Yes, getting the balance right.
And that's with charity, you know, the loving kindness, as you said, that is difficult. Well, actually, with temperance, with attention to it, isn't it? Because many sectors in their own lives are working to a higher good. I don't have a problem with that. They cause tremendous suffering that we consider is not actually for good reasons. But in their minds, they are working it in for the good. And once you realise, then you can have a more temperate view. Just on
you don't want to take an axe to them then, when you bear that in mind.
On the website, just the other day I read, and this is a respectable national organisation, that sectors are imposing deliberate cruelty.
Oh, yes. To see whether a mouse can register pain.
To them, it's just that they're not being cruel as such, no more than a painful vaccine.
Yes.
And they see it differently, that's the point I'm making.
Right.
Temperance allows a different view.
Oh, yes. So long as it doesn't fight against charity and you end up being paralysed, then. I mean, don't be too Hamletish about it.
Yes.
You know, again, you've got to be temperate about your temperance, haven't you? There are times when, you know, charging in is the right course of action.
I mean, on that point, I'm afraid I cannot let it go, because there is so much evidence now that using animals in research is a pointless exercise and has no scientific validity.
Can we not go into that? We can be off at a tangent.
I know.
This is I know, I'm aware of that, and I've only got 5 minutes left to say. So, justice, quickly.
The strong must protect the weak, and that will explode.
Right. The our duty, or whoever is stronger than, to the weaker, the ones in need, etc., whatever species and all that.
The master
well. Right, defy...
You claim to be the master species, if
you like. Right.
And,
but it's deferring to the rights, God's rights, for all these... I mean, I think, again, that goes without saying, really, doesn't it? It's a sense of justice that makes that inspires us to do any animal charity work. Fortitude.
Very important. Every time I go around one of my grandparents' house, they say, try and give me a vegetarian dish, maybe meat gravy and things like that, you know, just staying strong and explaining again that it's okay, you can live without it, I'm not going to curl up and die.
No, it's a holding on, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hold in there, folks, don't give up. I think a lot of people do give up because the struggle is just so immense, it's so uphill, isn't it? But if we can internalise all these, then, you know, we'll be better men than Gunga Din. Let's just move on then. We've been given examples of people who have exercised the virtue. And the Catholic Church, in the Catechism, names two people. St. Francis of Assisi goes without saying, everybody knows him. St. Philip Neri doesn't go without saying. People say, who? He is the founder of the Oratorian movement. A priestly brotherhood that Cardinal Newman joined. So, Bob-omb, this is going to be big news in a month or two's time. And he was a 16th century ethical vegetarian. He refused to eat meat. He was said when he was passing a butcher's shop once, if everyone was like me, they would not kill animals. He rescued lambs and sheep which were going to slaughter and gave them to friends to raise on their land until they died natural deaths. He was a one-man farm animal rescue service. He used to shoo flies out of the window. I mean, even flies. And this is the time when they were burning heretics. You know, he shooed flies out of the window rather than swat them. So his virtuous life is one of those that we can model ourselves on. As part of the virtuous life, we don't want to cause harm to any living creature, we want to positively help them, and that extends to human creatures as well. And as we all know, the vegetarian diet is a far greater good for the world than the meat-based one. So for the sake of the planet, the hungry millions of the world and all the animals in the world, there's only one diet a virtuous person can choose. And I say choose because there are occasions when choice is not available, in which case there's no lack of virtue involved. So you can be sort of dogmatic, but then you have to realise that there are situations, I mean, like in the Warsaw Ghetto or something, where, you know, if you ate a rat, that might keep you alive for the next few days. So there are times when... but, I mean... To have virtues, there's an element of sacrifice as well. So the choice would be very, very narrow and limited that would prevent you from following a vegetarian diet as a virtuous activity. But I just want to finish with one further Christian approach that should be acceptable, that could be acceptable to people from nearly every tradition in the church, particularly to those that use the language of priesthood. First, starting with the image of God... sometimes used, often used negatively as a barrier between our species and others, giving human beings superior privileges over animals. Obviously that shouldn't be so, any more than the chosen people of Israel were so much privileged as given a special responsibility. That is a privilege, but not in a sneery, I'm better than you are kind of way. It's a tough call to be chosen by God, to be called out in the ecclesia, the people of God. It often leads to persecution, pogroms, and the carrying of crosses. The responsibility of the Israelites was to lead the nations to the worship of the true God, just as that is the responsibility of the members of the Christian churches. And before the book of Genesis was written, the Israelites were led by kings, who, according to Middle Eastern traditions, were the physical manifestation or living image of gods, or in the Israelites' case, God. By the time the writing of Genesis took place, which is after the return of the exile from Babylon, so it's quite late, quite near our time, I mean to say, not early, although it talks about early things, obviously the earliest, but it was actually written quite late. By that time, there weren't any more kings in Israel and Judah. It was understood that it was the people themselves who were the images of God, God's representatives. They, us, were responsible for performing God's works, reflecting God's nature in a world God placed them in, with such powers as to recreate Eden before the fall, or to maintain the horrors and destruction sin let loose in it. They were given dominion, that's the other horror word that comes up in arguments about our use of animals. They were given dominion in order to perform their responsibilities. It's been horribly interpreted as a divine mandate for us to use nature entirely for our benefit. However, as John Berkman, an American theologian, puts it, God has chosen humanity to be an image of God's own rule in the world. This implies that people are to act as God's deputies, with the caveat, of course, how Christians are to rule over animals is directly connected with how humans understand God to be ruling over them. So now image and dominion are understood as reflecting God's rule, and for Christians we remember that ours is a suffering servant, not a tyrannical God. So how we best represent that God, but by service. And to whom are we to serve? To the world. There is no limit. Ordained priests have a limit to an extent, and that is the parish in which they've been placed. We, who are priests by baptism, are not restricted to that. We've not been given that particular task. We've been given the whole world instead. And that is everything that God saw was very good in the act of creation, an act that continues every nanosecond of every minute of every day, otherwise there'd be nothing at all. No universe, no nothing. All is sustained and maintained by God, just as everything is loved by God into being. And how are we to respond to that? In two ways, and they're both priestly ways. This is what I mean by the language of priesthood. Priests do things in two ways, and this is how we do things in two ways. First, by worship. By sheer thanksgiving for all that is, the whole package of life, nature and everything. That, of course, leads us to self-examination and contrition for all that we as a species do that destroys and harms creation. And that leads us to a yearning for closeness to the Creator, for forgiveness, reconciliation, even communion. We were made for this. It's our telos, our end, our purpose, as it is with every living thing, every creature. All is led to the glory of God, which is the union of being, of every being, with the Creator. Our human duty, therefore, is to give voice to the praise and glory of God on behalf of all, people, plants, animals, minerals, the lot. That's not to say they cannot praise God themselves. They do, by their mere existence, they do, according to the Catechism. But we've been given the privilege and the power of naming the God we worship on their behalf. We not only do that, but we present to God in the offering of the altar the whole of creation, especially suffering creation, to take up and redeem. Now, that's perhaps a bit too specifically Catholic, so I won't go into that here. I mean, I'd be happy to over lunch or whatever. But just go back to the first priestly duty being that of worship. The second priestly duty is that of pastoral care. Yeah, that's the bottom bit there. To tend the parish of the world, all people obviously, but beyond that, the world of creation. How do we do that? How did, in the Gospels, the mandate to do that? Did you visit me in prison? Did you feed me? Did you clothe me, etc.? So we are to feed the world, water it, cherish it, protect it, and in so doing it, we're doing it for God. For God is present in and to his creation, as God is present in and to each and every one of us. Therefore, as priests, which all Christians are, let's take up our duties of worship and care and see that our response to the question of animals goes way beyond that of merely of rights. So, thank you. That's my bit.
Thank you very much. We've got just over 5 minutes for questions.
Can you hear at the back?
Sorry,
picking up
telos.
The nature of telos. Yeah.
Such being the case, can we therefore see that an animal, a carnivorous animal, is not actually being cruel when it is, when the fox takes a rabbit?
Well, no, we can't use words like cruelty. They are value judgment words that can only apply to people with choice.
Yes, yeah. So suffering crept in there at the beginning of the world. And so, to me, that is a completely different form of
suffering as that inflicted, as you later explained. So I would hesitate
to talk about suffering in your
mind.
Because
yeah.
Animals do know how to die.
Yeah, there's an issue there that's unresolved in my book, and that is whether animals are created predatory by God intentionally from the beginning of time. You know, the way nature is the way it was always intended to be, and therefore that the fall, the Adam and Eve bit, you know, and all that, refers only to human beings, or the animals were in the peaceful kingdom and they didn't do any of that predatory stuff at the beginning, but when Adam and Eve fell, in other words, when human sin came into the world, it broke their peaceable kingdom, shattered it, and they became carnivorous. Death came into the world, suffering, predation, and all the rest of it. Now, all sorts of people like Augustine and many others, right up to today, believe that how nature is good. How it is today is good. Predation is good. Lions killing gazelles is good. That's how it is. That's how God intended it to be. Or you can say, no, actually, they're only doing that now because of human sin, bringing death into the world, kind of. I'm using imaginative language, obviously, but you know, it's difficult. I would say that predation is not God's intention, but that nature still has a perfect balance and, you know, makes the best of it. But it's a difficult one. Sorry.
Just in the beginning of Genesis, not only were God proclaimed a vegan or fruitarian diet for humans, it was also the same diet for animals.
Yes, which is what we hope for at the eschaton, the return or restoration of Eden and all the peaceable kingdom. But it still leaves problems about how beautiful nature is now. Sorry. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and when the human comes here on Earth, and it's very much on Earth, the lion shall lie down with the lamb.
Well, it's okay with us people who inhabit that mythical language. But if you talk to somebody for whom Genesis, Isaiah, eschatological, you know, perfection, all that, doesn't mean a thing.
No, but I'm putting into context what Augustine said.
Yes.
Yes.
No, quite.
I know one can say, well, you can challenge the Bible. There are lots of contradictions. It's been written time and time, blah, blah, blah. But I'm just pointing out.
Yes, absolutely. The peaceable kingdom at the beginning and the peaceable kingdom at the end of time, and we're living in the middle times, which is brutal and, you know, predatory and suffering and all the rest of it. But
surely most modern Christians don't believe in Genesis literally. They believe in science and creation. Not creation, but evolution.
So where does that fit in, then, with our hope that things will turn out better and that, you know, animals and people will live peaceably one day?
Well,
or do we not hope that?
Some people believe that humans are getting better, improving, you know.
More humane than they used to be?
Bad things from the past, like slavery and
well, so you don't have to believe in a literal Genesis to hope for a future peaceful kingdom. The two are not at all closely linked.
Okay. Right.
Sorry, missed that.
You don't have to believe in Genesis.
You don't have to believe in Genesis literally to hope for a future peaceable kingdom.
Yeah. That includes animals being peaceable with each other.
Exactly, yeah, quite so.
Evolutionarily? I mean, are they evolving into that?
No.
I wouldn't have thought so.
No. I mean, I'm talking eschatologically now. I'm saying you don't have to believe in Genesis literally.
Right, but it's helpful, though, isn't it, to give us an image of what the eschaton could be like?
Yeah, it's an image, but that's quite different from believing.
But isn't the eschaton also an image? I mean, it's not scientific, is it? It's
No.
It's imagery. It's metaphorical. I know we could. a year course could begin on that subject.
Yeah,
one more question. You've already had one, so could we ask the lady who hasn't asked yet?
Yeah. Animals, living being. We've just been talking about telos, the potential and the end of the living being. Now, to me, and maybe some others here, to be eating and taking the life of the living being is then frustrating God's natural law and the telos of the animal and its full potential. I do have an issue.
Okay, can I answer that in an ambivalent way? And that is, where human beings are doing it, who don't need to be doing it, yes, then that's an abuse of creation, and therefore it's a blasphemy against the Creator, and it's against natural. But if another fish is doing it, then
no, I am talking about humans.
but humans, yes. Because we have a choice and they don't. And it's all it really comes down to that, how we use the God-given choice, the privilege we've got of choice.